Begin. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good evening. Wow. Good evening, everyone. Thank you for joining us. What we are discussing tonight is the last in the series of our Shiurim about Rashi. I just mentioned before we went on tape that we are going to be taking off the next couple of weeks because I try to have some time to relax and to learn my own stuff. But the question tonight is, was Rashi a posek? Now, let's just define terms. Rashi, we know who he was. 1040 to 1105, he was cool. Posek. Posek means someone who is a halachic figure who decides matters of halacha. Now, we know that Rashi authored commentaries, no? Rashi wrote a commentary on Chumash. Rashi wrote a commentary on Shas. That's Rashi's major contribution. Can we derive halacha from Rashi's commentaries? Is Rashi a posek? That is the larger question that we will deal with tonight. Now, when we talk about Rashi, obviously there are two different people. There is Rashi, the author of his commentary on Chumash, and there's Rashi, the author of his commentary on the Gemara. No, it's the same person. But what I mean is that Rashi on Chumash probably serves a different role than Rashi on Gemara. Rashi on Chumash probably is dealing with the simple reading of the Pesukim, and sometimes Rashi on Chumash will make comments which are not true lahalacha, are not accepted lahalacha. A famous one, which I got in trouble for when I was in high school, is Rashi on Chumash comment that v'dibarta bom, that you're supposed to speak to your children in Hebrew, no? And I remember when I was in high school and I had like the Zionist bug in me, so I asked my rebbeim, I said like, how come we don't speak in Hebrew in class? How come you're saying shir in English? Aren't you in violation of the halacha? The halacha is that you're supposed to speak Hebrew, no? Isn't that basic? So my rebbeim basically said, Schwartz, get lost. This was like a common refrain, but that comment of Rashi is not accepted by halacha, no? It's not found in Shulchan Aruch anywhere. We don't paskin that you have to speak Hebrew. It's probably a nice thing to do, but there's no real obligation to speak to your children in Hebrew, correct? I hope like I don't get shot by the Zionist contingent. But what? Well, Rashi says so. Yeah, Rashi says speak to your children, right, in Hebrew. That a child is born, you should speak, right? Now, Rashi in Chumash also writes, for example, that when you make a sale, v'chitim kru mimkar lamitecha, when you make a sale, you have a choice between a Jew and a Goy, you should sell an item to a Jew, not to a Goy. Am I obligated to do that, lahalacha? Am I obligated to buy things from Jews, not from Goyim? If there are two stores on the street, one, let's say, for example, is called Just Kosher. The other, for example, is called, I don't know, a bodega. Am I allowed to buy the can of soda from the bodega when there is a Jewish store nearby?
If it's cheaper, yeah.
So that is actually what many poskim assume, that if it's cheaper, you don't have to buy from the Jew. But it's not 100% simple. If there's a real obligation to buy from a Jew, maybe you have to buy from a Jew anyway. Right? Rashi quotes that. It's not really found in Shulchan Aruch. This is a very big discussion in the context of Shemitah. Rav Yaakov Limon discusses the question that everyone talks about, whether it's preferred to buy heter mechira produce, right? Or is it preferred to buy produce from Arabs? No? Now, heter mechira means I'm buying from Jews, no? Is it preferred? Do I assume that there is a halacha to buy? Now again, it's a Rashi in Chumash. Rashis in Chumash do not necessarily completely carry halachic weight. It's something that has to be factored in, but that's not going to be our real focus tonight. Our real focus tonight is going to be Rashi and Gemara. Zev, you got a comment?
Do Rabban Rabban or anyone else count the Rabban as a mitzvah?
They don't. But one could argue that in the usual Ashkenazi train of Psak, if you have a major shita, you follow it. Even if, right? So then the question becomes, is Rashi a major shita? Right? The Rambam does not count it, correct.
But Rashi had made a list of 613, but the same would be in there.
Correct. If Rashi would have 613, it might be there.
That's right.
Yet, we don't seem to assume. Now, the classic work for us in halacha, I don't know if I answered your question, if I deflected it, but the classic work for that we use in halacha is the Beis Yosef, no? The first year that I ever gave on halachic men was about the Beis Yosef. The Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo, was awesomely cool. He lived from 1486 until 1576. That's a very long life when you think about it, right? 90 years is a very, very long time in that time. The Beis Yosef, born in Turkey, goes to Eretz Yisrael at the end of his life. He writes, and he tells you that his halachic book is Beis Yosef. Shulchan Aruch, he tells us, is a book to review. If I want to know the dinim, read Beis Yosef. If you want to quickly review all that you have to know, read Shulchan Aruch. That's what he writes, which is really interesting. Pardon the expression, I hope I'm not insulting people. But he writes that Beis Yosef is the book that the rabbis have to know. Shulchan Aruch is for the Balabatim. That's what he writes. Okay, not bad.
Who said that?
The Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo.
Oh, he said
that. Beis Yosef in Shulchan Aruch and Simin Yud discusses the following case. It's not so common. It's a case of hitil tzitzis al gabe tzitzis. Let's say you have a garment that has tzitzis on the four corners, okay? And then you're a jokester, and you come and you put another pair of tzitzis on the corners where you already have tzitzis. Right? Why are you doing this? I don't know. You have a little jukba molach. You have something's going wrong up there. So you make hitil tzitzis al gabe tzitzis. So the Beis Yosef points out that according to the Rambam, if tzitzis number two intend to passel tzitzis number one, if when I put the second set on, I intend that the first set shouldn't be the tzitzis anymore, so in that case, tzitzis one is going to now be passel, and I have to get rid of tzitzis one.
Take them off.
Right? You have to cut off tzitzis one. You can't have both of them on, because that would be baltosif. You're supposed to have only one pair of tzitzis on the corner, not two. It would be too much, no? So, if you cut one off. If you have in mind to get rid of one, the Rambam says get rid of tzitzis number one. Get rid of the original ones. Rashi writes that you have a choice. You could get rid of either one that you want. Right? Rashi says when you put tzitzis number two on top of tzitzis number one, do whatever you want. That's why Rashi understands the Gemara. Look at the Beis Yosef. Ula inyan halacha. Nira, da afagav da harosh. Mifarish kaperish Rashi. Kevon de Rashi. Mifarishu velo paskan. Havale harambam vaharosh. Chad legabe chad. Vahalocha kaharambam de mistavar tame. De miskavin lo sufe potem. Miskavin lo vtule kosher. Zuck the Beis Yosef. That even though Rashi agrees with the Rush, but Rashi is not a posek. Rashi is a commentator, not a halachic figure. That's what the key halachic figure in the Jewish people, the Beis Yosef, is telling me, that Rashi is not a halachic figure. Now, this is really interesting. That means that you cannot derive halacha from Rashi, because Rashi's job is to explain the Gemara, and not to tell me halacha. And therefore, don't learn halachas from Rashi. But that is what the Beis Yosef is telling me.
But if he's explained it, don't the people who do decide...
So Rashi explains the Gemara one way, but that doesn't mean... In other words, Rashi explains the Gemara one way. The Rambam paskins differently. You paskin like the Rambam, not like Rashi, because the Rambam's a posek, not Rashi. You don't say it's a dispute. Right? Rashi don't count. Now, the question is, what does the Beis Yosef mean with this? The Yad Malachi is one of like the classic works on Klolim and Shas. The Yad Malachi tells us that the Beis Yosef means that Rashi is not a posek. Meaning to say, Rashi is a figure who explains, but you cannot use Rashi for halacha at all. The Chidah, however, right, Reb Chaim Yosef David Azulai. By the way, the Chidah, anyone know what he did for a living? You might like this, Kira. He raised money. The Chidah was a person who raised money for all the yeshivot in Eretz Yisrael. And when he's traveling through Europe raising money, anytime he stopped off in the community, he looks in the community's library, and he wrote very quickly, apparently. He copied manuscripts. That's what he did. But he was raising money. Not a bad job, no? So, huh?
Do you want that job?
You get a commission.
Yeah.
This I don't know. So the Chida comments that the Beis Yosef does not mean that you cannot use Rashi for halachic purposes. He says what the Beis Yosef means is that the way he decided halacha is he had three big figures, no? Rambam, Rush, and Rif. And he passes like two out of those three. So what he's saying is Rashi is not a heavy hitter. He's not a cleanup batter. Rashi is a, I don't know, he's a second baseman. He's a utility player. He's a guy who can pask in halachas occasionally, but is not one of the big three. If I'm establishing a bezdin to pask in halacha for the Jewish people forever, Rashi ain't one of them. That's the way the Chida understands this line. And it's interesting to note, no one had this book until pretty recently, but there's a sefer called the Ravya. The Ravya is a German Rishon who is, 12th century? The Ravya, it's really a classic work. It's like a full halachic sefer. The Ravya in one place, it's in volume 2 of the Ravya, page 114. He discusses a question about taking off challah on Yontev, no? Did the shayla ever come up? You're allowed to bake on Yontev, correct? Let's say you bake on Yontev. You're not allowed to take off challah on Yontev because, right, separating challah is like fixing the food, right? So you can't take off the challah on Yontev. Am I allowed to bake the entire challah, which is including some part of it that is supposed to be challah, that should in theory go to the Kohen, but we burn? Well, if I bake the entire part of it, I'm baking on Yontev for no purpose. I'm only allowed to bake on Yontev to eat. I can't bake on Yontev to burn something. So what do I do in this case? So there was a big discussion the Ravya has back and forth. What do you do or not? And he quotes, what?
Do it the day before.
So if you did it the day before, you're great. But you are what we call an absent-minded professor. You didn't do it the day before.
Oh, you didn't make it up.
What? So Shabbos, Yontev morning. Not Shabbos. Shabbos you can't bake, yeah.
But isn't there a thing about you only have to take it if it's a certain amount.
Yeah, you only have to take it.
Make less than that.
What?
So make less than that. Make one loaf instead of five.
You have, it's Washington Heights. You have 45 guests coming over for Yontev lunch. Right? You know these big Heights meals.
In these apartments?
What?
In these apartments?
Welcome to the neighborhood, Frida. Right? This is how we do it. Right? Now, what I'm trying, so Rashi is quoted, the Ravya, volume 2, page 114, I didn't put this on the source sheet, but Ravya, volume 2, page 114, quotes that Rashi writes in his psakim, in his halachas, that what you should do is bake the entire challah, and then after Yontiv, you'll give a little bit to the Kohen, or you'll give a little bit to burn. Right? In other words, challah of chutz la'aretz, it could be ochel v'holeh v'achar kach mafresh. Rav says you're allowed to bake everything because in theory I could eat every bit. I just have to make sure something is left over. Now, the Apdoitzer, who wrote the notes on the Ravya in that place, volume 2, page 114, afterwards it says, one second, you're quoting a Rashi in his psakim? Well, the Rashi that you're quoting is a Rashi in Psachim, in the Gemara, in Daf Mem Ches. And if you're quoting that Rashi in Psachim, that means that the Rav Yos assuming that Rashi was a posek, that I could use Rashi as halachic sources. So that is an interesting source, I think, that does come up. Okay, let's continue our conversation. By the way, if you look in the Darkei Moshe over here, the Darkei Moshe, I get the impression that he's learning that Rashi is a posek, just not a first-rate posek, which is the way the Chida says it, not the way the Yad Malachi says it. Now, everyone who has ever studied a lot of Gemara with Tosfos knows that occasionally we do quote Rashi as a halachic figure. Let me give you a few examples, just very quickly. Tosfos in Shabbos on Daf Samechetz quotes that the Rashbam found a tshuva of Rashi that food that is somewhat edible, not completely edible, is not obligated in peyah. There's an obligation in Eretz Yisrael. You have to leave a corner of your field for poor people. And Rashi says that applies only to food that's fully edible. If it's not fully edible, partially edible, you don't have to leave it as peyah. Partially edible means that you can eat it if you're stuck. It's not like the type of thing that you'd normally eat. Well, wheat in the field is normally edible because you grind it and you make it into flour. But there's certain products.
It's not edible before you do
what?
It's not edible.
It's not, but it's a product that you eat, that everyone eats. There's certain products, certain like weeds or something that you are technically edible, but most people won't eat them. That's what we're talking about. Most people won't eat them. So do you have to leave peyah? So Rashi says you do not have to leave peyah. Now, why is this important? This is important for the following reason, okay? Just very quickly. This means that Rashi is writing a teshuva. The Rashbam says, I found the teshuva of Rashi, right? And he's writing a teshuva about something that is completely irrelevant for our lives. Do any of you ever leave peyah? In Israel today, do we leave peyah even?
Don't we?
No.
Why not?
We don't leave. That's a very good question. The Chazon Ish writes in Hilchos Peyah that we don't leave Peyah today in Israel because, technically speaking, we're worried that if you leave the corner of your field, there wouldn't be poor people would come. It would be just that everyone would steal your stuff, and it wouldn't really be a fulfillment of the mitzvah. The mitzvah is a trickle to the poor people. Today, rich people, anyone would take it. Well, so today, we don't leave Peyah.
At least the people who care about this, if they take about that amount and give it to the soup kitchen, at least.
So I don't know. I don't know if it's done.
So the poor people get instead of the...
Again, the poor people, I don't think poor people end up getting less today than they used to get, because today we have an additional obligation that came in at some point in Jewish history called giving Maaser Kesafim.
Okay.
Right? They used to not give a tenth of what they earned to poor people.
Right.
This is a new practice that was developed at some point in time. When that was, you have to listen to my Shema Maaser Kesafim. But the fact is, Rashi is writing a teshuva about something that was completely irrelevant in his world. That is interesting. I don't know what to do with it. Okay, I give you a few other sources of Rashi's. There's a Rashi that he quotes, Tosas and Pesachim quotes, a Rashi in his Siddur that's used for halacha. Now, Rashi has a Siddur. Let's just talk about this for a minute. There's a Siddur called of Rashi's. And this is often used as halacha, no? The quote over here, there's a discussion, do I dip the karpas in charoses or I dip the karpas in salt water, right? What do? You probably dip it in salt water, right?
Yeah.
But Rashi discusses that you dip it in charoses. Okay, very nice, very exciting. Siddur of Rashi. Why is this so important? So this is really important because most of the halachos that we know from Rashi, and we know probably, I don't know, a few thousand halachos from Rashi, most of them come not from tshuvos that Rashi wrote. And let me tell you a dirty little secret. There's no real collection of books called tshuvos that Rashi wrote. What happened was, different students of Rashi quoted that my teacher said this. And then later on, and by later, I mean in the 1960s, someone put together a collection called Tshuvos of Rashi. Elfbein. 1960s. Right? That means Rashi didn't really write responsa in the classical sense. Like today, people write responsa, and you put it together in a volume, and you sell it to all your friends. Right? People ask Rashi questions, and Rashi's students knew what my teacher said, but there was no collection called Rashi's responsa. Those responsa that we know from Rashi are really coming from books that Rashi's students quoted, my teacher said. Now, what's interesting to note is as follows. There are different halachic cultures in Germany and in France. Right? One of the big differences is, ready? Okay, I hope no one from the neighborhood shoots me for saying this, but Germans are very into their minhagim. Did you ever notice?
Listen, everybody's into their
minhagim. Right? No, not like the Yiddish.
Okay.
Right? The Germans are into their minhagim more than anyone else. Do you agree with this, Mrs. Byregan? Would you, but as an objective observer.
What about the Sephardic Jews?
I don't think to the same extent, but Germans are into their minhagim. Good. Everyone agree? Now, what's interesting to note is that there is no such thing as a siddur from Germany. But there are dozens of siddur. Now, when I talk about siddur, what I mean very carefully is Rishonim from the period of 11th, 12th century did not write siddurim. But in France, the students of Rashi write siddurim. So much so, okay, in this book, in Grossman's book, he gives you a list of siddurim written by students of Rashi. Rabbi Ushmaya has a siddur. Rabbi Simcha Vitri. Rabbi Yaakov ben Samson. Rabbi Shmuel ben Parigos. The Rashbam. Right? There's a siddur of Rashi. There are tons of siddurim of Rashi students. What this meant is as follows. French culture is very into trying to figure out what's the proper way to do something. And if I decide that this is the proper way to do it, you know what I say about everybody else? The heck with them. This is the proper way. And I am going to write my own siddur. Because in the town of Schnippeshuk, I'm the rabbi. And I decide that in Schnippeshuk, we should daven the way I say we should daven. So I am going to write the Schnippeshuk siddur. And this is a French thing. And students of Rashi, who spread out throughout France, Rashi became a big figure. He's in Troyes. He has a yeshiva. Students come to him. Then they spread out throughout France. The students of Rashi are writing siddurim. Why are they writing siddurim? Because they are telling you that in this community, this is the proper way to daven. Right? In Germany, no one is going to write a siddur. Because in Germany, they are very bound by minhagim. And you know what they're going to do? They're going to say, how should I daven? I should daven the way they davened 50 years ago, 100 years ago, 150 years ago. No new rabbi in Germany is going to come and say, change the practice. No? If you say v'yismuchu b'cha Yisrael mekad shei shemecha and say v'yismuchu b'cha Yisrael ohavei shemecha, right, you get esrogim thrown at you. Right? The idea is that the Germans are more bound by their minhagim, says Grossman. This is his suggestion. But one thing we know is that the students of Rashi write a lot of halachos from their teacher in a siddur. Now, we should be careful. When we're talking about siddurim, it does not necessarily look like this. Their siddurim did not necessarily have texts of prayers. Their siddurim might have just had the sequence of prayers. Right? Mirzok da, noch de mirzok da. We say this, then
they
that.
They did that in French.
What?
You said they did it in French, not in
They did it in French, not in Yiddish, although I firmly believe that anyone who was really Jewish spoke Yiddish. Let's be honest.
Of course,
right?
Of but you're absolutely right.
But the point is that a siddur is not necessarily a text. It could be a sequence. And the siddur goes through the course of the year. So in the siddurim of Rashi and his students, you have halachos throughout the year. Okay? So Pesach comes. How do I bake matzah? Well, I open a siddur and I figure out how to bake matzah. Because the siddur tells me everything, no? My grandmother felt this. I remember my grandmother, Allah Hashalom, she felt that the siddur is like the most important work in Judaism. And any real question you can answer in a siddur, no?
What kind of a siddur did she have that tell her how to make matzah?
Huh? First of all, she had like this big Yiddish carbon mincha siddur.
Oh,
okay. Right? And the carbon mincha siddur has a ton, I don't know if it has in there how to bake matzah or not, but they do have three different versions of Gotfen Avram. Right?
Okay.
The fact is,
you can get at least a term paper out of that.
Oh, for sure. But the fact is that a siddur is a halachic guide to regular halachos. And most of the halachos that I know about Rashi come from his students in the Siddur say, I saw my Rebbe do this. For example, on Rosh Chodesh, I saw my Rebbe Rashi did not make a bracha on Hallel on Rosh Chodesh. Rashi didn't make a bracha on Hallel on Rosh Chodesh, right? Why? Well, it's only a minute, Rashi, but you don't make brachas on Menhagim, whatever it is. But the fact is, right, that siddurim are important halachic works. The two real sources we have of halachos from Rashi, again, until the 1960s when they pulled it together and they put out books called Tshuvos of Rashi. But the two real sources that we have are Siddurim and Halachic Monographs. Halachic Monographs are some students of Rashi would put out books on Hilchos Shechita, small areas of Halacha. Hilchos Shechita, Hilchos Nida, Hilchos Mezuzah. They take one area of halacha and they focus on it. This is also a distinctly French type of work. Sfaradim Rishonim, when they wrote books about halacha, they wrote about halacha. The Rambam, you see that? He writes about everything. The Rif writes about everything. Students of Rashi are taking halachic areas, right, and they are writing on it. So there are works from students of Rashi on Siddur HaGet. How do you put together a get? They're working with students Rashi about melicha, about how to salt meat. There are works, right? These halachic monographs are from students of Rashi. Now, what is interesting to note, okay, just a few points. If you look in, I give you here in English from the Bar Ilan Shut that they talk about how Rashi is a posek. Rashi is well known as a posek, a number of halachic anthologies, some published, some yet in manuscript, originally in Rashi's yeshiva. These works are known as Sifrei Debei Rashi, were taken from the collection of Rashi's writings and teachings prepared by Reb Shmaya, Rashi's secretary, and other students. Consequently, large portions of each of these are similar. There's a collection of Rashi's response. So, I'm sorry, Elfbein is 1943. My mistake, I said 1960s, 1940s. Practically speaking, it doesn't matter that much, etc. And these books, these halachic monographs, are on small areas of halacha. And what that means is as follows. There are certain areas of halacha that we do not have anything from Rashi about. For example, classical Choshen Mishpat. Right? Reuven says he owes Shimon $1,000. Shimon says, no, you don't. We have almost nothing from Rashi about these things. Now, does that mean that there were no monetary disputes that came to Rashi? Probably not. But Rashi's students, when they wrote these halachic monographs, or when they wrote Siddurim, which are the way we have Rashi's halachos, there's no place in the Siddur to speak about a fight between Yikim and Getzel, right? You're not going to find it in the Siddur. You're not going to put it in a halachic monograph, and therefore we don't have these types of issues in Rashi's tshuvas. Okay, good. I want to talk about two other points. Again, I'm not giving as many sources. Again, you could read the English, some of the sources of Rashi. Rashi was at the one. On the one hand, Rashi is very bold. He will paskin his way against his teachers. On the other hand, Rashi is very deferential to his teachers. And this ends up leading in interesting sorts of ways, which I will explain to you. Again, Rashi's two major teachers are Rabbi Yaakov ben Yakar and Rabbi Yitzchak Halevi. Okay? One is in Mainz, one is in Worms. Those are his two major teachers. Rashi tells us a story that one time when he was studying in yeshiva, there was a bunch of birds that someone found shechted outside. Right? So they find a bunch of birds, their head is severed. Question comes up, can we eat them? Can we have a fleishiga lunch? Apparently it wasn't the 9 days. Can we have a fleishiga lunch? That's the question. So Rashi's teachers say, it's permitted, right? It's permitted. And Rashi's teachers say, this, by the way, comes from the Mordechai in Chulin, some in Tavkuf Tzadi Dalet. Rashi's teachers say that even though Goyim are the ones who are bringing these birds in, it's going to be kosher, because the Gemara at the beginning of Chulin has a statement that if you find Matzah Gedayav Tarnagolav Shechutin, if you find shechted animals, we assume rov mitzuyin etzor shechita mumchen hein, most of the people who do shechita are experts, and therefore it's going to be kosher. So Rashi's Rebbeim said it's kosher. Rashi, little whippersnapper of a kid, says, you're wrong! It's not kosher. Because when the Gemara says that it's kosher, that's talking about when most of the shochtim in town are Jews and are kosher individuals. But here, where we are in Mainz, We have a very small Jewish community and a very large Goyish community, and most of the people who slaughter animals are non-Jews, and therefore it is non-kosher. That's what Rashi said. So Rashi disagreed with his teachers. And Rashi said the birds are treif. But then at the end of this responsum, again, it's not really a responsum in the classical sense, it's just a statement that Rashi disagreed with his teachers. At the end, Rashi says, and don't think, God forbid, that when my teachers ate those birds, they were eating treif. Because we have a principle that behemton shel tzadikin in HaKadosh Baruch Hu mevi takol ha'yedein tzadikin atzom l'koshik hein, right? The Gemara at the beginning of Chulin talks about the chamor v'pinchas ben ya'ir, that even the animal of a tzadik won't eat non-kosher food. Certainly a tzaddik won't eat non-kosher food. So it can't be that my rebbeim ate non-kosher. Rather, it had to be that my rebbeim noticed that the Jews cut one particular type of cut and the goyim cut a different type of cut. And presumably they knew that it was chucked by a Jew because they saw the cut this way. So the fascinating thing over here is that Rashi's arguing on his teachers. He says, don't follow what they say, that the birds are kosher. But my teachers probably had something else up their sleeve to defend them. Is that?
This might be a digression. So,
okay. You know. I'm okay with those.
Or skip it one. But is it like, why does he have to be not sure of the process of his revan? I mean, why can't he just say, you know, maybe you couldn't tell the difference between how the cuts were made, but you know, because the cut is wrong, that doesn't allow to get into deep trade, therefore. In this instance, even though they were distinguishable in fact, like the Matthias of the animal said that they were something, you know.
Yeah, so apparently Rashi felt that it can't just be that by some miracle they ended up getting a kosher bird.
I mean,
it has to be that there was a substantive reason, so he makes something up.
Right, but it's not that it has to be an ace, it's like it's probabilities, right? It's, you know, whether it's 51%, whether it's 51-49, you know, either direction, right? It's just a question of which population you choose to take the majority out of. Like, it wouldn't be an ace if it was kosher. It just wouldn't be 51%.
That's true, but at the same time, as a matter of halacha, Rashi really feels that if the majority of the town is non-Jewish, which apparently Mainz was, so therefore the birds are going to be non-kosher. End of conversation, right?
Side question. Yeah. Does a chef have to be Jewish?
Yes. If a non-Jew chefs, it's not going to be kosher. That's correct. Yeah. Shkita Sakum is Nevela. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
the first. So now, another example where we see, I think, that Rashi is defending his Rebbeim. In other words, even though Rashi thinks his teachers are wrong, he comes up with some explanation how they got to their wrong type of thing, right? Or why for them it wasn't really wrong. Look at this. This is a tshuva of Rashi Siman Shin Pei Beis, the last source I give you. The Halev Yodea Tarad HaMatsoy Ba'agor Bikavim, right? The heart knows how busy someone who's in the middle of the grape harvest season is. Therefore, Alkein Letzedek Yachri Eini Adoni Reb Ezra Et Kotze Mili, therefore you'll judge me favorably even though I'm writing short. The question that you asked basically is whether Basar B'Cholav is Asar B'Nosein Tam or B'Shishim. Okay? The halacha is that there are two different types of Isurim in Judaism. Sometimes a tiny drop of treif falls in and it makes everything non-kosher. And sometimes we have the rule of batel b'shishim, that it's batel 1 in 60. Now, Rashi holds that basar b'chalav, a mixture of milk and meat, is batel b'shishim. Rashi's teachers held that basar b'chalav is asar b'mashahu. Any tiny amount of basar b'chalav that falls in is going to be asar, right? Even though the Gemaras and the Mishnayos speak about bitul b'shishim by basar b'chalav, Rashi's teachers understand that means if I have one drop of milk that falls on a big piece of meat, and that piece of meat is 60 times larger than that drop of milk, so then it's permitted. But once I have basar b'chalav and it falls somewhere else, any amount of basar b'chalav is going to be usher. Now, Rashi says my teachers are dead wrong. And the reason why my teachers are wrong, Rashi says, is because they did not learn Maseches Avodah Zarah. Look at this one, no? I'm not making it up, okay? I got from my teacher, Reb Yitzchak Halevi, when we learned Chulin. That lulei gamin meham esechtem lo avdinan kavotei, das damam asisim bavodizor, the basa b'chol b'mashehu. In other words, Rabbeinu Yitzchak said that basa b'cholav is aser b'mashu, any tiny amount, and even though the Gemara in Chulin says no sin tam, we follow a Mishnah Avodah Zarah that's aser b'mashu, because it says in Avodah Zarah it's aser b'mashu. V'anilo nosati libi ozlach kor b'dvarim. At that time I didn't investigate. Hallo Rabbeinu lo haya shone meseches Avodah Zarah. Shebas yirkan v'asakti meseches Avodah Zarah v'hevanti mitoch shiyash ala horos mimen basuchav mashu v'nekam ta'amim, etc. In other words, Rashi says, I heard that my teacher said that Basar B'cholav is also a tiny bit because that's what it says in Avodah Zarah. I didn't really learn Avodah Zarah then because we didn't study Avodah Zarah. Later on, I studied Avodah Zarah. I realized that my teachers are wrong. Now, what does this mean? This means, first of all, Dr. Soloveitchik has in his introduction to this book, Wine in the Middle Ages, Dr. Soloveitchik has that it's fascinating, but Avodah Zarah was not really studied. It was a mesechta that the Rishonim, before Rashi, did not write any commentary on the complete mesechta. We mentioned when we gave our introduction to Rashi on Shas that every part of Shas had a commentary before Rashi, not Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah was not studied before 1096. Why that's true, I don't know. But it doesn't mean that no one knew anything in Avodah Zarah. It just means that it wasn't a mesechta that was really studied. But here's Rashi. And Rashi says that my teachers made a gigantic mistake. They made the type of mistake that turns over every shayla in the kitchen, no? According to Rashi's teachers, every kitchen shayla is going to be treif. Unbelievable. And Rashi says, you know what? I'm going to defend them and say that they're wrong at the same time. And the way I'm defending them and saying that they're wrong is by saying, you know, they just didn't learn Avodah Zarah. And if you learn Avodah Zarah, you realize that they're wrong. If you learn Avodah Zarah, you realize that, if you learn Avodah Zarah for real, you realize that as a matter of halacha, basar b'cholav is going to be aser b'shishim. It's not aser b'mashu. So Rashi will disagree with his teachers, but he'll do so with explaining what they do. And Rashi disagrees with his teachers in a very respectful sort of way. In this book, Heichal Rashi, on page 37-38, Rashi has a discussion with his teacher about an animal that was shechted, and the lungs of the animal were stolen. Is the animal kosher or not? But usually you have to check. But they can't find the lungs after the animal shechted.
Before they checked it.
So is the animal kosher or not? So that's a question. Rashi's teachers assumed it's not kosher. Rashi said it is kosher. Rashi writes that I disagree with my teachers. And I disagreed with them to their face. And I brought many proofs to them that they're wrong. I do not publicly say that they're wrong because they're my teachers. But I'm telling you, my students, that they're wrong. Right? Fascinating, Rashi. Right? In other words, on the one hand, he's bold enough to disagree, to tell his students that my teachers are wrong. On the other hand, he won't publicly give a shiur and say that it's wrong. He just like whispers. When the shayla comes his way, he says, my teachers are wrong. Right? So Rashi will disagree with his teachers, but he'll do so with a lot of respect. The Gaonim, those are the sages in Bavel, 9th to 11th century, whatever it is, or 8th to 10th century, however you want to count the Gaonim. The Gaonim say many things. Rashi never disagrees with the Gaonim. Rashi has an approach, which is a standard approach in Ashkenaz, that the Gaonim are going to be correct. Now, there was a case about liver that's cooked in water. No, usually you have to broil. You have to broil a liver to get the blood out. If a liver was cooked, we usually assume it's treif. There was a dispute with the Gaonim. Rashi felt that perhaps you can permit it, but he says, I'm not going to say it at all. And I am going to be mvato my das. My own opinion I get rid of in favor of the Gaonim. Rashi was very lenient about many things. We'll just conclude with this. In Dr. Soloveitchik's book, he points out that Avodah Zarah, as we mentioned, was not studied before Rashi in a systematic way. Rashi has tons of kulas in Avodah Zarah, in particular, in terms of wine of non-Jews. For example, Rashi says that all non-Jews don't really know about Avodah Zarah, and therefore the wine might not be forbidden to derive benefit from. It's only forbidden to drink from. Rashi says that when you send wine from place to place, you only need one seal, you don't need two seals. Rashi says that wine only becomes wine once it's filtered. Right? If you begin to jump on it in the vat, it doesn't become wine yet. Only when it goes through the gargutni, only when there's hamshacha, when it's filtered, does it become a problem. Most Rishonim disagree with all these points of Rashi. But Rashi was lenient on every point over here. What's interesting to note is I think Maseches Avodah Zarah is the greatest proof that Rashi is a posek. In all those cases, Rashi explains the Gemara one way. And Rashi's changing halachos based on the way he explains the Gemara. And that proves to me that Rashi is a posek, which of course is what we began with. So again, thank you for coming. And we'll continue, I think, either the end of August or the end of September. You have to stay tuned. It depends on my mood. Okay, thank you.